Hey everyone, and welcome again to your show of shows. It's the RCR Show 43, recorded live Sunday, January 20th, 2013. The Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by Cyber Ears, and they can host your podcasts and audio files too. Find out more at cyberears.com. I'm doing a pretty good little Leo Laporte sort of thing there, aren't I?
Yes, you are. Well done.
And now a message from Ford. No. It's me, David, and I'm hosting this time, plus I'm joined by the usual cast of characters, Carrington and Earl. Hi, you guys.
Hello.
So let's move right on into our items of interest and the news. So we'll start off with you, Carrington. Tell us about the top 10 ZX Spectrum games of 2012.
No, can't make me.
So let's move on to Earl then.
Okay. You have made me. Sorry, let me turn off the phone here. So on Eurogamer.net, yes, I get around. I hang out in forums. I lurk. Somebody named
Blur. You're a secret Euro person, aren't you?
I am secretly Euro.
Canadians. So,
Blurk posted what I thought was a really interesting list of games. He posted a top 10 list for Spectrum games, and for the ZX Spectrum, as those of us in Canada and Europe and everywhere in America would say.
So are there more than 10?
Well, what I liked is, and I thought indicative of how vibrant that community is. It's a top 10 Spectrum games of 2012. So not top 10 of all time. These are the top 10 of new games that came out last year for the ZX Spectrum. And some of these look, I haven't played any of them, but some of them look really, really good. So it's over at Eurogamer.net in the forum, and we'll have a link in the show notes. In particular, he linked to a game called Antiquity Jones, which I thought looked fantastic, developed by a UK developer named Paul Jenkinson, who seems to have done a good almost, I'd say, like 8 to 10 games in the last couple of years, text adventures and maze games and action games for the ZX Spectrum. So these are from developers who are pushing out a bunch of games. There's a good variety here. There's, you know, shoot 'em up games and a couple of maze things, and just, you know, a really interesting and colorful list of brand new games released for that, you know, particularly old platform. So that was an amazing indication of how alive that community still is. So quite impressive. Because frankly, I'm an Apple II guy, but I don't think I could come up with a top 10 brand new in 2012 Apple II game list. I don't think I could come up with 10. So this is amazing, I think.
There just seems to be a lot more nostalgia in Europe about their old game systems and computers, isn't there?
Yes.
I mean, compared to the North America,
and particularly the Speccy. It's got quite a following.
Hmm.
Maybe because nerds are all speckies.
But also like the 8-bit music scene and stuff. It seems to be more alive over in Europe.
Well, chiptunes are big in the U.S. as well. But I just haven't seen the new game development. The Atari world seems to be still really big with 2600 games. There's new Nintendo games that come out. In fact, we'll have a link. Wired did just a couple weeks ago, an article about three brand new Nintendo games for the NES. So there are three new NES games that come, you know, they've been published in box, in cartridge. You can buy three brand new games, all of which looked fantastic. I thought particularly Battle Kid 2 looked really good. So it's just interesting that made Wired, and the Spectrum clearly has a great and vibrant development community for it. I just wish it was happening with the platform that I love. So someone go out there and make me new games.
Well, you'd think that could be a possibility, because a lot of the stuff that I see, the activity in the Apple II community these days, is on development tools. Mm-hmm. Really, really nice development tools. So you'd think with those tools at your disposal that making some games wouldn't be as hard as you might think.
I guess, and as well, I complain about it, I am a software developer, so I should be stepping up and doing this myself. So, and I have been looking at what I'm going to do for Kansas Fest this year for Hackfest, so maybe I'll try to at least start on a game or something, but clearly I'm part of the problem if I'm not developing these things. So,
I mean, even you know, the English and the Europeans, you know, they even have the Retro Gamer magazine.
Oh, the English.
And we don't have anything like that here.
You've got nothing.
Huge, Yeah. Why doesn't something like this exist here?
You can't handle it.
Why can't the three of us make this?
Because we're lazy bums.
Time is why. Well, time, money, but aside from that.
Time. You've got tons of time, Earl. You have no excuses.
Oh, I'm loaded up with time.
Let's see. So, Earl, we'll move along to your topic, the 30th anniversary of the Model 100. Did I say that right? It's a programming contest for the 30th anniversary.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're doing a programming contest. You can get more information on this over at Club 100, and there's a link up in the show notes. Let me see. I've got that link up. I just wanted to hit a couple of the details here, that there's no specific theme for this particular contest. You could make anything you want for the Model 100, a game, utility. They say here are some examples, cool graphic display, music, whatever. The drop-dead date, they're saying to submit is March 15th, but there was some discussion that that may be extended a little bit. There was speculation about that on the Model 100 mail list. And you have to submit a fully functional program, and there's instructions here on this page where to submit it and that kind of thing. I was thinking of trying to do something like this because this is another community where there's some cool development tools, and there's actually some dev tools in production right now, like the Virtual T emulator. They're trying to dial in a built-in assembler that's going to go with that emulator. Again, more information on that is on the Model 100 mailing list if you're interested. But I think the Model 100 is such a cool little computer. So if you're a Model 100 fan, a Model T fan, then head on over to this and see if maybe you want to crank out some software.
But, Earl, why no love for the 102?
Oh, the 102's fine also. it's just a Model 100 with a couple of
I have two 102s. I can't participate.
Okay. Well, that's
that is cool. They are a great computer. And, you know, both of mine came from a newspaper I worked at, and obviously they were used in there at newspapers a lot.
Used extensively by journalists, yes. So that's what's up with that.
How are we looking in the – how many people are watching this? Any chatting going on there? Any
comments? Talking to myself.
Really?
Well, you can tell how many people are watching us, David, but anything
can
in the
I?
Chat room?
Oh, I see. 7 viewers. Okay.
David can't tell. David's slow.
Well, he can tell me I'm a doctor.
Well, let's move into our next topic, and this one's a little bit – we just want to touch on it. The reason it sort of – I mean, I was aware of it before just getting ready for the show today, but I became aware of it again when I was picking an eBay auction. And so I started picking an item, and it turned out it was one of these items, and I didn't feel good about it, you know, and I guess it'll become obvious. But essentially – the headline here, and there's a link in the show notes to the posting by Salem Ismail and the Classic Computing Computers discussion list. But so it says, Vintage Computer Festival Archives Stolen by Tri-Valley Recycling in Stockton, now selling on eBay as seller TVR Sales. If anybody's listening or watching right now doesn't know, Salem Ismail is a longtime collector and computer historian in his own right, and he was the founder of the Vintage Computer Festival. You know, of course, the original one in California, and then he helped organize the one in the East, you know, in New Jersey, which Evan Koplitz now runs. So I don't know what more to say there. Basically, I know he ran into some hard – I don't know all the details. I haven't read a lot of – I think he's –
Why'd you do it, David?
Well, I know he's posted some, like, I think, documents. Have you read any of those, Carrington or Earl?
I glanced through them because I became aware of this the situation – from A2 Central, Mike McGinnis, my No Quarter co-host, posted essentially that link on there saying, hey, there's all this material that looks like it was stolen now being posted on eBay. So I followed through and I read through the link. I was kind of surprised that that got on A2 Central just because the word stolen is such a loaded word. So I was like, wow, everybody, before you put that into the news, you better have your facts straight. So it seems to be something where two sides are arguing over the legitimacy of this. Like, was it that the goods have been rightfully seized because of non-payment of rent and the lease in California permits that? Or was it that he did pay things in time and they have been seized incorrectly and unlawfully, and with the problem is it looks like the items are being sold. So if they were seized unlawfully, then that's a really bad situation. If they were seized lawfully, then it's really disappointing, but we shouldn't be throwing around the word stolen. So the problem is I don't really know much about the situation. It seems that he had some trouble paying the rent, but at the same time, I don't know what the local laws are. I know here in Canada, we are a lawless wasteland. And if you can trudge through the snow, you can take what you find. That's made us the tough group that we are. And plus, you have to say sorry. So there's that.
But it's,
I still want to know why you did it, David. Why did you take all this stuff?
it's very sad, for Salem's been someone who's been, you know, very involved for a long time, of course, and the VCF is a huge thing, and you know, and I'm helping the Plan One here and through his help with the vintage.org website and stuff. But I wouldn't know all the details or anyway, just bring that to people's attention, and I think Salem, obviously, he wrote this, and he wants people to be aware, and he's posted some documents. I think they're all letters to the landlord, you know, who he's suing now or fighting in court.
Mm-hmm. It is a very unfortunate situation. I'd have to say, you know, we don't, like you guys have said, we don't know the legalities around it. I wouldn't presume to tell other people what to do. For me, myself, mm-hmm. if I looked at one of those items that was on eBay, I would be very hesitant to bid on it at the moment, just because of the legal imbroglio, you know, that all of this that's happening. So definitely something to be aware of.
And that was kind of, for me, I just didn't feel right having one of my auction picks being one of these items.
Well, oddly, right, so. And coincidentally, my auction pick, just to give a bit of a spoiler, is actually something from behind David at the moment. I've decided to start auctioning off David's stuff. So I've been quite inspired by this. So that rocket behind you?
Yeah.
Check out eBay.
As long as you get top price.
No reserve, maybe.
You know, this, and it comes apart in the stages, and they have, you know, so you can recreate everything.
I'm also going to auction off David's place in this show. So next week, who knows?
That would be cool. Of course, as long as I got the proceeds, then I'd be all right with that.
Yes.
Hey, now. What's up with your commitment, man?
So, Karen, you take it away with the Inside the Miss Pac-Man Factory.
Oh, I'm next. Okay, so I stumbled across this video on YouTube. A few people have posted it. We'll have a link to this particular one, I think is the original posting. It is a five-minute tour in the Miss Pac-Man Factory from 1982. So just really interesting to sort of see the line of Miss Pac-Man. Men, Pac's men? I don't know what the plural of Ms. Pac-Man would be.
I guess it was in a U.S. factory?
Nobody knows. These were made in secret and maybe on the moon. But yes, I believe it is the U.S. factory. So it's just inside Bally Midway. I found it interesting for a couple of reasons. One, if you're interested in arcade games, like the things sitting behind me, it's sort of neat to see the line of them going in the assembly and how many of these things were coming off the line.
Yeah,
back
cranking
in 1982,
them out.
Just cranking them out. And it's so funny because this is right before like the major home crash and that kind of stuff. So that's interesting. I also found it really interesting that Kevin Curran, who might know that name, posted a comment on the YouTube a channel there. The channel I'm linking to is Media Burn Archive. So seems
I'm
like
sorry
they posted
to say,
it first.
I don't know that name.
Okay, so in 1981, I guess it would have been, Doug McRae and Kevin Curran were MIT students, and they did a hack for Missile Command, basically an enhancement kit for Missile Command, to turn it into something called Super Missile Attack, and then they got sued by they formed a company called General Computer Corp, I think GCC. And then they got sued by Atari, saying, hey, you can't just, you know, slap some new code in our machines and then start selling it. So they settled. I can't remember if it was in or out of court, but it got settled. And they said, you know, the agreement was you can't do these things without permission anymore. Well, meanwhile, they had already started a new add-on kit for Pac-Man to turn it into a game they were going to call Crazy Auto. And so, but then rather than throw out what they were doing, they went to... because it had Namco was looking for something to do with Pac-Man, like to follow up with it, and they ended up selling that kit, the Crazy Auto code, to Bally Midway, and that became Ms. Pac-Man. So Ms. Pac-Man was actually just a kit, and they just changed the graphics a bit, and bingo. And then Ms. Pac-Man became, you know, an even bigger hit sales-wise than the original Pac-Man was. So it's just sort of neat to see him comment. I'm like, I know that name. That's a dude. Because people in there was somebody else that commented saying, I wonder if the people working on this line, assembling these things, know that they're working on basically a stolen machine. Because the myth, I guess, has always been that they just did this under the radar and then it got sort of stolen. But Kevin actually posted to clarify. He said, no, hold on. No, we created this and then we sold it to them. And I was perfectly happy with it. We came up with a deal and they didn't yank it away from me. We sold it to them. And then that became the Namco's game for Ms. Pac-Man. So just sort of interesting to see him out of nowhere pop up and post in YouTube. So, and mostly it's interesting to see the tour. I liked watching 5 minutes of Ms. Pac-Man's being assembled.
Oh, it's great. And it's also, of course, the machine, because it's all new. The machines are all bright blue and new and clean. You know, I'd have to guess, it looks to me like it's in the United States, I'm assuming, or North America, because there's a variety of, you know, different people, kinds of people. Mostly women, though. Almost entirely women in this factory, it looks like.
I hadn't noticed that, but come to think of it, you're right. It did seem to be mostly the gals working on the line there and assembling it. So
for the war effort.
the war against little dots.
We will prevail.
Yes. So unfortunately, it doesn't seem that there's that happening anymore. I do not believe there's a factory churning out arcade games. It disappoints me.
Right. At least not in North America. So take it away, Earl, about the, this
take
is
away,
a great
Earl.
Story about the anniversary of the SX-64. And
yeah.
Today is a pivotal day for this. And so go ahead.
Yeah, I wonder if Barry's actually listening.
He is, and he's in our chat room, and he says that the...
I emailed him.
Yeah, he wrote the SS64 party has been great in Amsterdam, and in the U.S. it's on right now.
So the Netherlands is, what, 8-9 hours ahead of the place?
They're actually a few years ahead of us in a lot of ways. So.
Yes, they are. Nice. Nicely done, Carrington. Yeah, so they would already be, like, you know, partying it up. But as we speak, the Puget Sound Commodore Users Group in Washington is having a SX64 party at Starbucks.
They're 6 hours ahead, just by the way. It's 10:17 p.m. there.
6 hours ahead of who? Of you guys?
Of me, I'm sorry, yeah.
Yes.
So it's 10:17 p.m. in Amsterdam right now.
Gotcha. Nice. So, yeah, so they're pretty much done partying. Well, no, I don't. Yeah, they stay up kind of late over there. I've been to the Netherlands a couple times. But
have you?
I have indeed for work, yes.
Been in those special cafes
in the
and those
stays in
different
the
color districts.
But yeah, I wonder how the Puget Sound group is doing, because right now, today, they're enjoying at a Starbucks the 30th anniversary of the SX64. I wonder if, in fact, the Starbucks is enjoying it. I'm wondering if their lights are dimming outside. As, you know, they've got a dozen or two people bringing in their old 80s microcomputers and plugging it in.
I know. I can't wait to see some pictures.
Yeah, I've got a couple friends in that group, so I'll try and get...
Barry in the comments says that there's pictures on his blog, so I'm just going to go track him down
of
right now.
What, okay. from the Amsterdam party?
Yep.
Nice.
Oh, because I looked earlier.
And we'll make sure get posted in the thanks, Barry, and I'll make sure that they get posted in the show notes for everyone.
So happy birthday, SX64, many happy returns. I'll go hug my SX64 today, and I wish I was in Washington, but hey, you know, I got a podcast with you guys. So there you go. I couldn't party, but I will fire up my SX64 today and tell it happy birthday.
Yeah, if you find the pictures, Carrington, change that link there.
Yep, I'm looking right now. Here we go, party people.
Party people. So for our last item of interest and news, it's, you know, it seems like I've always felt that Star Trek was honorarily part of computer history. And I don't know why, but I think Batman is too. Why not?
Okay,
up the rules,
sure,
right?
Why not?
There you go.
So anyway, on a lighter note here, with the Batmobile, the original 1966 television show Batmobile sold at an auction. I just thought that was cool.
For how much?
What the heck? $4.2 million.
Holy cow.
I can't believe I got outbid, too. Like, just so close.
It's one of a kind.
Does it really have fire that comes out of that?
Oh, I think so. I think it's basically a propane burner. They can just, you know, and it right. And, you know, you can buy, I think recently, there's like at least one company in the United States, I think, that makes reproductions of these.
But well, I don't have $4.2 million, but I think it would be really cool to be driving down the street, you know, step on the gas and hit that button with the propane.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the original show is kind of cheesy, but to me, that's the Batmobile. I don't know. That's just always been that's the real Batmobile.
Yes.
You know, for me as well, like as much as I've enjoyed the various versions from some of the movies, you know, some more than others. But for me, mm-hmm. it still is the case that the original 60s Batmobile is sort of the iconic Batmobile for me when it comes to that sort of thing. So, yeah, I would dig it. I'd love it. I'd be like, hello, ladies. Yeah. And then there would be no ladies.
I bet you there might be.
There might be ladies.
That Batmobile would be a chick.
I don't know.
I would clean up on cosplay, though. It'd be awesome.
There'd be some geeky ladies for you, Carrington.
That's the best kind. So anyway, yeah, great car, but remarkably high price. Holy cow.
Oh, yeah. I was actually surprised, too. I didn't know if I thought it would have sold for that much. It's kind of funny. I had to dig around that article to finally find the little area where it set up. It was right at the beginning, you know. But I'm, like, looking in the body of the article, and I was like, well, how much did it sell for?
It can talk to computers. It can talk to fax machines. It can talk. It fits in your briefcase. It fits in your business. It fits in your life. But the remarkable thing isn't just what it can do. It's what it can become. Introducing PowerBook Duo from Apple.
Pardon me. See, you bought that trendy computer.
I fear it says a lot about me.
Did it say why it won't run all the popular business programs?
I'm not into perfection.
Compaq computers run thousands of business programs.
I can't relate to that.
And Compaq is portable.
My horoscope advises against travel.
Compaq can grow as your needs grow.
But isn't personal growth more important?
Seriously, do you think you made the right decision?
Who needs to be right all the time?
Compaq. It simply works better.
All right, so we're going to move into the retro computing gift idea. So it's my choice since I'm hosting. And basically,
so that car wasn't your choice?
Yeah. Well, it would make a really nice, you know, retro, well, computing gift idea, geek gift idea.
Yeah, geek gift.
Now, sure. Now the Batcave computer, that would be an awesome retro computing gift idea. I saw one of these just yesterday at the Atlanta Historical Computing Society. We had our monthly meeting yesterday. And so one of the members, Brian, brought one of these. And if you look, so that we have a link to the Bletchley Park site where you can buy the Enigma E is what it's called. It's a kit computer that recreates the functionality of the Enigma. And then below that, there's a link to our webpage that has some pictures from the club meeting. And you can see Brian's that he made. It's very cool. So, let me click over on there.
Wow. So basically, do they have a bigger photo?
No, but look at the one from our group. It's better.
Oh, okay.
It enables you to build your very own battery-powered electronic Enigma machine. Does not include wooden case, which Brian built one. Requires only basic soldering experience, extensive, easy-to-read 60-plus page manual. It's 120 pounds. So how much is that in dollars? I can figure it out real quick.
Million.
It's about 100. Ooh, almost $200. $190, but it's very cool. Do you guys see the pictures too?
Well, I'm looking for the pictures on your site.
Yeah,
January 13th meeting. Which one is? Oh, is it this fourth one?
It's the middle top one.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, there might be more pictures than that. I haven't had a chance to look at the pictures yet, so.
And for our listeners, you can head over to bletchleypark.org.uk and click on the shop to go searching for it. It's called the Enigma E.
And, of course, that's
cool.
And also, you can go to atlhcs.org, and you can see, because there's lots of close-up, really great pictures of the kit here, too, further down.
So it's a functional kit, and I mean, mm-hmm. you can actually cipher some things and decipher them, and
yeah. So it's very neat. So that's the wow. choice. Now,
I
also, since while you're over at Bletchley Park in their little shop, you know, look around at some of the other stuff. So I went ahead and added one of the other items, which is called the Pocket Enigma. And so there's a link in the show notes to that. And basically, it's a one-wheel version of a real Enigma in a smart CD case designed exclusively for and only available through Bletchley Park. Pocket Enigma is a little cipher machine.
Very nice. That's awesome. I remember I selected, but haven't posted yet. I had considered another thing from that same shop once as a retro choice. They have a Bletchley Park edition of Monopoly, I think it was. I think it's a Turing edition
oh, really?
Of Monopoly. Yeah. So if you're looking for Monopoly, you can get a Bletchley Park/Turing Monopoly that they sell as well. I just can't find it at the moment. But it's in the shop there somewhere. So definitely an interesting shop and worth looking around on. So
this is associated with Tianmak, is it?
With what?
With the National Museum of Computing? Because that's at Bletchley Park. Is this same group?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. Right?
And you can get a shirt with their little green dots that go below as part of their logo. So
it says it's the National Codes Center, Bletchley Park National Codes Center.
Yeah. So is that the?
Oh, then it says Visit Museum is one of the links. Welcome to Bletchley Park. I gotta think it's in the same. I don't know a lot about it, but yeah, it's Bletchley Park, home of the Codebreakers.
Yeah.
It must be the same place, right?
Well, it's the same Bletchley Park. There might be multiple things that go on there.
Hmm. I'd like to go there one day.
Me too.
Very cool.
They won't let you in. You're a bit of a badass.
It'll be closed. Darn it. They closed it.
I see you coming.
So let's move into our eBay auctions this time around. And so, Carrington, you go first.
I am selecting the EMP10 EEPROM programmer. Now, I don't know. Do you guys have any experience with EEPROM programming?
No.
I don't, no.
Your lives have been empty up till this moment.
I want to have, because I've got a couple of computers, including the K-Pro and the PX8.
Right, okay. So,
I
could
use some custom EEPROMs for.
Exactly. And a lot of things more things than you would think come with EEPROMs. When you start looking at old equipment, if you get into arcade systems like this, I refreshed myself on EEPROM things, because I have a couple of other arcade units coming. And to keep those alive, not necessarily this one, because it's based on different sort of hardware on the inside that they hacked together on my fixed Felix Jr., but EEPROMs, different. In fact, I'll talk about it in general for a second for our listeners in case they're unfamiliar. So the E in EEPROM is erasable. So an EEPROM is erasable programmable read-only memory. Then there's also PROMs, programmable read-only memory. When you look at an EEPROM, you can imagine you've got a little chip, and on the top of it will be a circle. There's like a little window, and it literally is a window. So that's how you can sort of tell an EEPROM from a different sort of chip. You'll grab an IC, and it'll have that little circular window. And the way you erase an EEPROM is to expose it to light, to UV rays. So an EEPROM mm-hmm. eraser will be a little box with simply like a blue light in it, and you just turn on a timer, leave it in there for 20 seconds or so. Really, 10 minutes, I guess there are. I leave mine in for way too long, and that'll wipe it out. And then you have to... Now it's fresh, and it's time to program it. So a lot of things they'll go bad sometimes. So things with EEPROMs, the EEPROMs go bad. They get exposed to light, and it messes up their code. You imagine it's a less stable system than mm-hmm. a typically burned, you know, unchangeable IC. So, but it has the flexibility of being able to add different code. That's why you can take a game. That's why you can take like for instance, earlier we were talking about the people who would take a missile command machine and turn it into something else. Take a Pac-Man machine and turn it into something else. The way you're doing that is the program code is on these EEPROMs. You yank them off, change the code, put them back in. The EMP10 has been my go-to EEPROM programmer forever. They stopped making them quite a while ago, which is why they fetch big prices on eBay. And there's lots of EEPROM programmers out there. They all have to work with a computer, though. Like, they're not standalone devices. They're really just things that can relay the data into the chip. So you need to have an EEPROM programmer that can talk to software that knows about the specific chip. And the nice thing about the EMP10 is the software that's been around for it, which is DOS-based, so it's old-school software, but was upgraded by a large group of people for many, many, many years. So sort of any EEPROM you can come across, it's going to know how to talk to it. It also, if you're looking at the picture, if you're looking online, it's got a larger section where the EEPROM would slide into than just a typical EEPROM because it's adjustable. And so it can work with various sizes and different numbers of pins. So you just start to look at it and say, okay, I've got this. It's an Intel whatever or what have you. You stick in the EEPROM programmer, you launch the free software and say, I want to program the following. If you're working with like game ROMs, all those ROMs have been dumped. Like that's the ROM programming that enables things like MAME to work. Those are just the dumped ROMs. So the software that will come with an EMP or that you use with an EMP10 can check your ROMs as well. Like you can check the software and say, I've got this item, read that ROM, does it match anything out there? So you can have a random EEPROM and say, what the heck is this? And it'll look through the database and say, oh, that is, you know, bank 2 number 4 for a Pac-Man machine or what have you. Or it doesn't match, which means it's probably corrupt because it knows about everything out there. So it's a really handy thing. Unfortunately, they haven't been made for ages. And so if you want to get into this sort of thing, it's a great one to work with. Really stable, really easy. Unfortunately, requires DOS, but it's, you know, you can pick up a really cheap DOS computer. Anything with a parallel port is going to work with this thing. And it's fantastic. So it's unfortunately $150. Buy it now. But you don't see them that often much cheaper than that. They used to be way cheaper. You used to be able to easily get them for $50. They seem to just be getting a little more rare. So if you want to get into EEPROM programming, I highly recommend the EMP10. If you can get it for, you know, less than 100, it's a better bargain. But I haven't seen one for a while, so this is the first one that I've come across on eBay. So I am choosing that.
And it's in Toronto.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, then maybe I'm selling that.
I didn't think I was selling it. That's a good pick, Carrington. Plus, I love anything that has the initials EMP in it.
Right.
Just...
yes. And Owen and Barry, who's still hanging out in our chat room, just reminded us about the EEPROM, the double E on the end, which is the electrical erasable programmable read-only memory. And so no UV lights needed for that. But I'm an old-school UV guy. I like my EEPROMs.
Wow.
And Eric says that's every day for him. So, Eric, I envy your lifestyle.
I lost a little bit of that, Carrington, would you say?
It wasn't for your ears. It was for our listeners.
What? You guys are breaking up a little bit. Yeah,
oh, Carrington, I think you're
getting a little bit of internet stutter here.
I think recently, Carrington, it seems like you've had some problems with your bandwidth.
I've got problems with you.
Hasn't he the last few times?
It happens
when
I'm juggling this stuff. When I have Safari seems to chug when I've got both YouTube open to do the comments and also Google chewing away through this video stuff.
Well, we'll let Earl do some talking now then. So I'll take it away on this unopened Timex Sinclair 1000.
Well, you guys know I like my new in-box type stuff. So, we don't talk about the Timex Sinclair 1000 very much on the show. So,
no, we don't.
But, and you know, it was a very important computer in its niche, the low cost, just take it home and plug it in kind of computer. So, I thought this particular one here, this auction was really cool because it's a Timex Sinclair 1000, a 16K RAM module, and some software. All new in the box, unopened. Now, you know, sometimes with this new in box stuff, you got to wonder, is it really new in box? I mean, not to impugn any particular seller, it's just that there's always that question mark. This really does look like it's new in the box, because if you look at the picture on eBay here, if you look at the blow up of the picture, it's shrink wrapped and it has what looks like an old sales label on the shrink wrap.
Oh, yeah.
So if it was, you know, not really new in box, it's a really elaborate attempt to make it look like it. So I think it really is new in box, and how cool is that to get an 80s computer and the RAM module and the software, and the starting price is really reasonable. They're starting it out at $20. And you've got to buy it now at $150 if you want for all that. So I thought the price, I love it when sellers are reasonable with what they start something at. So if that's something that interests you, this looks like. Now, of course, I don't know, you know, with Commodore stuff, it's always a question mark whether you'd want a modern new in box because
or want
so many
one at
of the
all.
Commodore. Well, assuming you would, Carrington.
Oh, that's a big assumption. You're making an ass out of assumption.
With the new in box, you'd be a little worried because I used to sell them back then, and a lot of them came out of the box broken. So, you know, it could have been sitting for 30 years in the box and doesn't work. And I don't know what the quality control was like on the 1000s. So, I mean, you could
there's
get so,
there's actually so few components on it.
Yeah, you know, it would probably work, right? Because it really is a simplified, if you've ever seen the inside of one of those, it is a simplistic computer. So there you go. That's my pick.
Nice.
It's very nice. Very cool. Let's move into, so my pick this time is the Sharp PC-1262 pocket computer. And I think it sort of stands out a little bit because it comes as a bundle or it's a whole system. It has the little thermal printer and the cassette recorder, and it's got manuals. So a really nice system. Right now it's at $26.99, so I got 4 days to go. Shipping's reasonable. To me, it's $15. Where are they located? Cincinnati, Ohio, so it shouldn't be much different anywhere.
Did you say $27?
Yeah, right now it's got 9 bids. It's at $26.99. But I think it's fairly reasonable. And, of course, it's reasonable. It's fairly unusual to have the whole, you know, to be able to get that whole little thing like that.
Yeah, and you know, typically the when they've got the printer and all that stuff, they sell for quite a bit more than that.
Oh, I see. So basically, the cassette and the printer, I guess, are one unit in this case, and then the little computer connects into it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've ever seen that before, this specific pocket computer or whatever.
I have one that's similar to this. In fact, I have a whole setup that's similar to this, and they're really cool.
In the comments, Grumpier Than Thou, our buddy Grump, says the 1262 has the CE-125 printer.
The CE-125. I do have one of those. Yeah,
you do?
They're a cool setup.
So yours looks just like that? With the cassette?
Yeah, I don't know if I've actually got the 1262 model or if it's one of the comparable ones. But it's that size and it looks like that. So I've got three or four of those little pocket computers, the Sharp pocket computers. One of them has a 8K expansion RAM and is really neat. That's a slightly bigger one that runs off of AA batteries.
And this thing, it says it does not come with a charger, so I have not been able to test either the printer or pocket computer. I'm pretty certain the pocket computer takes batteries. I don't know about the printer.
The pocket computer takes some of the little thin watch batteries.
Or it'll run on blood, but you have to, like, poke your finger and there's a little hole in the side.
Sweat.
Yes.
But I would imagine, though, you could get one of those universal, you know, power adapters and probably get it going.
Well, the thing is, these guys aren't the printer, you know, that whole unit doesn't tend to be happy unless the NiCads are happy. Mm-hmm. And sometimes with these old things, the NiCads aren't happy. Like with mine, I have to replace.
Is that a technical term?
Happy. I have to replace the NiCads in my setup because right now it's not functional.
Well, you know what? It sure seems like a quick show today, because that's
well,
it.
Well, I want to bring up a comment in worth mentioning. Andy Collins. I was in the show because we were talking about ZX Spectrum. I had said, what would people recommend game-wise if you wanted to get into it? Because it seems to, you know, between classic games, new games, that kind of stuff. And Andy recommended some classic games, Manic Miner and Jet Set Willy, both of which I've played before and both of which are really good. And Manic Miner, I think, has an iOS version that came out recently. But he also recommended Attic Attack, I guess it is? I guess we pronounce it Attic Attack, which I'd never even heard of before. So I am looking forward to checking out that. So there's three ZX Spectrum game recommendations from Andy. So thank you.
Cool.
Nice.
And also people in the comments are just sort of talking about EEPROM stuff in general. And that they're all cooler than us. But we already knew that.
Well, do you have any Carrington? Do you have any closing?
Do I have any Carrington? Oh, I've got Carrington. I got tons of Carrington.
He is full of Carrington.
I am chock full of Carrington. No, I've just been really, really, really busy. I have some fun stuff for show and tell, but okay. I have been a crazily busy Carrington. Oh, other than today, it's been about a month since we've done a double take podcast because my co-host was away, but she's back, and so we recorded today, so that will go live. That and the latest No Quarter will both be going live this afternoon, well, so that's exciting. So
let me speak
of,
as one of your fans. We're not listening anymore, okay?
Right, no? You're out. Gone. That's okay. Finally.
We can't count on it.
Try to clean up that audience. So, yes, so that was exciting. So it was fun to record that today. So.
How about you, Earl? I see here you were dropping out of the Retro Challenge. No!
Oh, I got to. I'm just too terribly busy. And I haven't sent an email to them yet, but I'm...
By busy, do you mean lazy? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, that's how you pronounce it. However, hey now, I came out with the Retro Bits in December, and there's going to be another one within a week or two here. So
cool.
Retro Bits is back on the rails. And
do you have any... can hint at anything about it? Or?
Yeah, no.
Is it an interview?
It's not an interview, no. In fact, there have been quite a few interviews in the last few Retrobits, although the last few Retrobits is a long time since they've been so spaced out. But I'm always spaced out when I do Retrobits. But that's what's going on my side. Just, wow, busy. What about you,
David?
Well,
as for me, thanks. Thank you. I have a couple of exciting new VCFS announcements. And the first one being, so you heard it first, our audience, is we have a keynote speaker, and it's going to be Robert Tinney, the famed artist from Byte Magazine.
Wow, very cool.
Yeah, very, very exciting. So he'll be showing off, obviously, a lot and talking about a lot of his early covers. And there'll be some of his artwork there. And he'll be selling his prints and signing them and different things like that. I don't know all the details yet, but there's a link in the show notes to his site, and you can look at some of his art from the Byte days. You can still buy prints and stuff from him, but that's an exciting announcement. The second one is that we're going to be in a slightly different venue, and there'll be more information on the site and in the press release and all this. But it's really at the same place where it was planned. It's an old CompUSA. But it turns out the CompUSA here in Roswell, Georgia, north of Atlanta, was actually a regional office. So so they had the big, the CompUSA, right? And right next door was a regional office for CompUSA. So we're actually going to have the show now, not in the old CompUSA, but in what the regional offices were. And it really is going to work out better because Lonnie Mims, our main big co-sponsor, he's doing essentially what's now called a pop-up Apple Museum. And so when you walk into the building, it sort of flows into some office spaces. With
you just had to get your Apple Museum.
Yeah, there's a joke here. Yeah, too. but anyway, so it's going to work out nicely that he's going to have a kind of a nicer venue to create his space and the little museum, if you will, and then it opens up into a warehouse where the actual exhibitors and all our stuff is going to be. But yeah,
what's
the joke
a pop-up
is that
Apple Museum? Is it like a Jack in the Box, like bring, and Apple II comes?
Well, pop-up meaning not permanent.
Oh, okay.
So like boom, here the museum's here now.
Oh, okay.
It's funny.
So kind of like
a
flash mob. Apple Museum.
Yeah. I joked to Lonnie, in fact, because we met and toured the other space and talked about it, and I said, I'm going to write a little article and say, darn it, Apple wouldn't build my museum idea, but my friend Lonnie sure will. I think I'm going to actually try to play it up that way, because it's kind of funny, because really, he's sort of doing that.
And you got it about as geographically far from Cupertino as you could possibly.
Right.
Maybe the southern tip of Florida might be a little further, but...
what's my other announcements here? So that's exciting. And on the last announcement, well, there's two more. So also, now this is, we're going to try real hard to make this happen. It's going to be a bit of an obstacle trying to get internet connectivity. I think we're going to be able to, but we're going to be able to have Vince Briel. Vince Briel and remotely assisting people during those kit building sessions, and then Julian Skidmore assisting during the Fignition build sessions. So that I think that'd be kind of neat.
That would be very neat. If you guys couldn't get internet, couldn't you get somebody with a phone that had, you know, one of those little, what do they call them, a Wi-Fi hotspot sort of?
Yeah, I think that's
things,
what.
Something.
Yeah, we definitely can't get internet in the sense of wiring the building or whatever. But I feel pretty confident we're gonna be able to either use Clear, or one of the 4G LTE hotspots like you're saying.
And yeah, then, and a Clear then, spot that might work.
Yeah, and then what we were just talking about it, where at the front entrance where it could get good reception, we'd probably put it there, and then put another repeater going out to the exhibit area so it would spread out. So that's exciting. Then along the same lines, we're going to do two live podcasts from the show. And I don't know what our schedule is like, but we'd hopefully like to be able to do our RCR from the show. So if that's okay with you guys, we'll kind of
if it's on and off Sunday, why don't we do a special show?
Yeah.
Next up on a very special Blossom.
Actually, I will look that up on the calendar here and see if it works out. But that's cool with you guys. And also, the boys from the Retro MacCast, and I don't know if they've said 100% they're going to be there, but they've talked about it, and it sounds like they're fairly committed to coming and to doing their show.
So maybe they'll only be partially there? Is that what you said?
Yeah, maybe only one of them will show up, or they'll only drive halfway. Yeah. They'll stop at the Georgia border and turn around.
They just want to check out that museum. You finally got your museum.
Yeah. It's gonna be pretty awesome. It really is. Lonnie Mims has got a huge collection. He's got the Apple One. He's got pretty much everything. And in telling the story of Apple, he's going to he'll have a couple of outsider things like a Xerox Alto and Star.
Oh,
and those
nice
sort of things.
Very
yeah.
cool. I've so, yet to play with a Star in real life, so that would be a treat.
You coming?
No.
Man.
Screw you, wrong coast.
It would be very cool, David, if you could have some live video from the show.
We're gonna try to do that too.
Possible, but that would be so cool.
You know, because worst thing is we'll do what we're doing right here. We'll just have a stream going over YouTube. You
yeah.
know?
See, on that weekend, I may be busy though because I'm going to be launching my own little David Museum, which has a little tiny Apple Museum inside it, and a little tiny David inside that. It's awesome.
And artifacts from David's life. I remember
that'd
we were
cool.
talking about.
It's
that.
Mostly just empty. It's
his
really a metaphor for the emptiness of David's life.
His easy bake ovens, I think you were saying you had.
Yeah.
I forgot about those. Awesome.
I know. I'm way behind on getting my website going. Toyovenmuseum.com.
Nice.
I have that, really.
He does, remember?
I wasn't doubting you.
One day I'll get it going. All right, well, we better
Everyone
wrap it up.
Go over to toyovenmuseum.com.
Any closing shots?
Just, you know, as always, appreciate the people watching us live here and commenting. It's
oh, any last comments before we go from our commenters? No?
Karen Valet says that if
Karen
the Apple won't let you...
Yeah. He's having bandwidth trouble.
Yeah, Carrington, you're pixelated.
So I'm going to wrap it up, guys.
All right.
Everybody, join us again for our next show, which is 2 weeks from now, Sunday, February 3rd. And remember, you can always join us live to watch, listen, chat with us at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific at youtube.com/RCRpodcast. The links and show notes will be at rcrpodcast.com shortly, as well as the audio show. We're RCR Podcast on Twitter, so please follow us. You can check out the forums that we participate in at vintage-computer.com. And we always appreciate feedback to the show, so send that to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. Obviously, write us an email or send us some audio. We haven't had that in a while. Do that. Please tell people about the show on Twitter and in forums, and we'd appreciate it if you leave us a review on iTunes. That would be very helpful. So until next time, Retro Commute. Who wrote Commodore Rules there?
I didn't do it.
Carrington?
Yeah, it was me.
Bye, guys.
Bye.